Yeah, the one thing that
about the color computer
that I sort of struggled with was the keyboard. It was I just found it really hard to type on, and I think at the time I was thinking there's got to be a way to sort of upload a program to this thing from another source, so I can use a regular keyboard. You know, isn't there a serial interface in the back?
Right,
I wonder how hard that would be.
So there's an interesting thing that you bring that up. So there actually is, I think, a fourth implementation that will actually use the Bitbanger serial port on it for a terminal to basically run a DEC-style terminal, like a 220 or 420, or I think 220 or 320, I think is what it named. 420 would probably work too. And the reason why, or no, I take that back. It wasn't fourth, it was APL for an interesting experience. And I think the reason why it supported that was some of those DEC terminals supported soft definable fonts. So you could actually upload the APL font into them and actually have a pretty authentic experience using APL if that's your thing. But yeah. The other thing today that the Bitbanger port gets a lot of use as is for the drive wire interface, which is a peripheral emulator that sits on the end of the serial interface. It's sort of a cheap way of getting mass storage and communications.
Right.
And I think they're supposed to be in some state of rewriting it in Python, because I guess it was written in a fairly an older dialect of C, but not old enough to be fully compatible. And I think it was written on a Windows host that is no longer supported and doesn't run properly on modern Windows hosts, for that matter. So hence why it was getting re-implemented in Python. And I guess the developer who did the original DriveWire may have, you know, walked away from that project at some point. Always seems to be the case.
Yeah, he hit a stumbling block, and you just sort of throw your hands up and say, I got to walk away from that.
Well, it's more like the, you know, I wrote it. It worked for what I needed it for, and now I'm doing something else, so.
Right, yeah. Right. Time to move on. Yeah.
But, yeah, I guess it would be possible to redirect input-output to, say, like a terminal on the serial port if you wanted to do the other way around. I know, like, on other systems, there are sort of that ability that people have written programs to do cross-system development so that you have access to a modern editor on a modern computer, but you can then, you know, transmit your code and run it on real hardware.
Yeah, I would need to do that, I think. I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I sometimes like to fire up the old machines and actually do work on the old machines, like when I'm at a show or something, just because, you know,
that's
sort of the time to do it. But, yeah, if you're doing some other system development, you know, having cross-assembly, you know, cross-development tools really speeds things up.
Yeah, for sure. And, yeah, so I was doing some reading about C64 a while back, and there seemed to be, it seemed like there was no clear understanding of, how do I say it, like the memory management on the thing, as far as how memory was laid out. Is it that complicated, or?
I don't think it's that complicated. I think it's actually quite simple. But it can get complicated when you're doing things that perhaps violate VIC-2 timing, and there's sort of lots of traps for young players, so to speak, in the sense that if you're trying to do something that is very cycle-intensive, that if you don't do it at the right time, you have a problem. But memory mapping is not that complex. It's basically you've got an I/O port at an I/O port and a data direction port at memory locations 0 and 1, and it basically is tied in to the PLA, and depending upon, you know, which states you have the output lines in and whether you have cartridge in asserting the XROM or game ROM line determines, you know, the memory configuration and memory map layout. Common tricks were, or not necessarily tricks, but common things to do would be, like, if you wanted to modify, say, the base ROM, like, there is a Jim Butterfield demo that he used to do frequently showing that you could basically copy the contents of the basic ROM to the RAM that is memory mapped beneath in the same memory location, and then disable interrupts and then switch to the RAM, you know, switch out the basic ROM and switch in the RAM beneath it, and then you essentially have a functioning copy of basic running in RAM that you can then modify, and he would, you know, change the ready prompt to banana as an example.
Ah, interesting. Very interesting. Yeah, I bring that up because a friend of mine once said, I wrote a little something, it was nothing special, but he said, well, if you really want to impress me, you'll create something that will just totally put ROM away and boot up whatever you've written. And,
there are RAM only configuration, which makes it hard to do I/O, but
right.
Where you have to bank in and out the I/O when you need to do that. But I mean, there were systems that did that normally, like the operating system GEOS, I believe, had code beneath the I/O block that it did run, and there was essentially a routine in there called init4io, I believe, that what it would do is it would bring the kernel ROM and the I/O block back into the memory map and allow you to use regular kernel calls. When I say kernel, I mean kernel, which is, I don't know if it's was an affectation or if it was a typo. But really, it's more like a, you know, CBM's version of a BIOS.
Interesting.
A simple firmware interface that was common between all of the 8-bit lines.
And I've always wondered how one handles cassettes.
Uh-huh.
Now, is there...
If you're running Jiffy DOS, you don't.
Okay. Gotcha.
What does one
do if you've got a pile of cassettes that you want to preserve, you know?
Put them in a audio cassette player and record them to a WAV file.
Okay, yeah.
That will work, believe it or not.
Oh, wow. Very cool.
You might have to futz with it a little bit and test it to make sure that you can get the data back out. But there have been tools to do, like, wave-to-tape files for the emulator, for the emulator.tap file conversion and back and forth. But, yeah, that's kind of the quick and dirty way of most tapes, or just, you know, some type of frequency shift keying or FM encoding, so, and it's, you know, functioning in the audio range, so you could, in theory, just sample it.
Right.
Open VoIP
right.
929-299-1269.
Like I was recently looking at the TI-99-4A's cassette interface, because one of the projects I wanted to do was kind of a more simplified terminal for some of these systems that don't completely kick out the basic interpreter, but are kind of, you know, interchangeable, kind of modeled after the DECGG microcomputer / terminal, where it was essentially more or less a home computer-like form factor, computers, the keyboard kind of thing, but it had local BASIC in it and had the ability to switch control back and forth to the to an upstream host system on the end of the serial connection, and it could, you know, drive the terminal mode or transmit BASIC programs or otherwise control the computer, kind of like JavaScript before there was JavaScript.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting.
That you can, and I was interested in kind of doing that from a, you know, simplified program, and I'm like, well, what's the minimal thing that you can use to get, you know, get code on the machine? I'm like, well, cassette interface, and it's like, oh, okay, what did the TI-99-4A use? It's like, oh, it uses some type of FM encoding in the signal. Okay, and it's pretty well documented that, you know, you've got a synchronization block of ones and zeros and, you know, record header and data blocks and then a repeat block just in case the first one isn't, you know, checksum, you know, data block, I think there's a checksum and then it repeats the block just in case.
Yeah. Very, very cool. Very cool. It would be neat to write a, I don't know, code to wave.
Yeah.
And feed that back into the one of these machines.
Yeah, and I think there are tools to do that. To say go from like say if you're interested in the Commodore 64, there are ways to essentially go back and forth. I think there are some tools for that are like wave to tape and tape to wave. So you would use, you know, like the Vice versatile Commodore emulator system. And it basically do your coding in that, or, you know, you don't even have to do your coding in that. Like I said, you can, if you're in working in emulation, you can pretty much use whatever you want. And you can either, you know, use a cross assembler or C compiler, like CC65 has a, I guess it started out as a small C compiler, but it has a lot of features of a full C compiler today. Of course it has an assembler built along with it, so you can basically write your code in a regular editor.
Yeah.
Assemble it with CC65's assembler, which I think is CA65. And I think you can even get it to produce the necessary 2-byte load address, so you can basically have a program file you can just, you know, read from the file system rather than have to have an emulated disk.
Yeah, it sort of reminds me of, you know, I had a tape player of my car, and I bought one of those devices that's basically is a tape, basically.
Yeah, it's a cassette form factor with a interface that, you know, interfaces to the magnetic tape head and then gives you a little mini jack.
Yeah.
Or a little mini plug out on a cable.
VoIP 929.
Yes, I've used those. Those are horrible, but you know, they do work in a pinch.
Yeah. Interesting. So is this Midwestern conference, is it frequent?
It's yearly.
Yearly?
Okay. So this Midwest computer, or the Midwest Game Classic is usually in the spring, and it's every year. You know, obviously during some of the pandemic year, it was not functioning, but for the most part, every year. He did move to Milwaukee a few years back, and I suspect it will stay there for some time.
Could definitely be a reason to take a trip out that way.
And then there are a bunch of other shows as well in the Chicagoland area. There is the Cocoa Fest, which is the first weekend. It's every year, but usually in the spring. This year, it's first weekend in April. And then there's the Vintage Computer Festival Midwest, which is in the fall usually. I think it's September 8th and 9th, whatever the weekend is around that date. Might be 8th and 9th or 9th and 10th, I forget. And that's a big all-system show, computers and games and whatever people tend to bring. We've got a new venue this year, so it will be hopefully bigger than ever. and then the local Texas Instruments TI-99-4A group has a small show up in Evanston, Illinois, which is a near north suburb of Chicago. I think that is scheduled for Saturday, October 26th, if I remember correctly. But the two big shows in the area are probably the Midwest Gaming Classic, and that's going to be more if you're into classic games, you know, classic video games and computer games and things of that sort. There's often cabinet games and pinball there as well.
Oh, I am a big pinball enthusiast, so I play in league where I live. And
cool. So, have you ever been to the Pinball Expo? Also in the Chicago area, usually in the fall, sometime late October, I believe.
No, it's on my bucket list though, for sure. Mm-hmm. I'd really, especially Wisconsin seems to have some really great players. So maybe I can combine the both, the computer show and the pinball.
Well, that would be the Midwest Gaming Classic, then, would be the one to go to.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. There is a website called PinMap, and you can just drop in a zip code, and it will tell you all of the closest pinball places that you can go to. So I've always wanted to. Some people do a 50-state tour. Yeah.
Well, some of the other things that's interesting about the Pinball Expo Chicago is they often also run tours of out to the what is the name of the company? The Stern Pinball Factory.
Yes. Yeah.
Since they are kind of the last surviving old pinball manufacturer.
Yep. Yes. Yes, indeed. Yeah. A kind of, well, I guess not really a computer, but definitely some interesting electronics in pinball, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, some of the later pinball machines are microprocessor-based.
Yeah.
And most of the modern ones that are being made today are certainly 1269.
Yeah. They even have updates.
Yep.
Yeah, for sure. I'm always fascinated when one needs repair and they open it up.
Yep.
Really interesting. Especially the really old ones. Jeez.
Yeah, the electromechanical ones.
Yeah. One was open the other day, and I was amazed. And the fellow was telling me, he said, hey, you know, if you're going to start buying machines, collecting machines like me, you might want to start with the mechanical ones because they're a heck of a lot easier to repair.
Yeah.
Him, basically, because he was saying how, like, a lot of the newer ones, when you go to, if a board goes or what have you, it's a lot harder to source it if the company's gone or...
Yeah. Otherwise, you're going to be, you know, troubleshooting it at a component level, and if there's anything unusual on it, you might not be able to get the part, I guess. Some people won't even troubleshoot it. It's like they were supposed to be field module repairable. In other words, the whole boards were intended to, you know, come out and then go back to be remanufactured. So they, you know, when they were installed in arcades and bars and whatnot back in the day, if it failed, usually a technician would just come out and, you know, swap boards and
right.
take the other one back for repair.
Yep. Chat's talking about it's illegal apparently in South Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, in some places, even in Illinois and Chicago, it used to be a problem, I guess, at one point in time for any sort of coin-op machine. Because they were often considered gambling devices.
Right.
By some entities. And, connected with organized crime.
Right.
I know in Chicago, any sort of coin-op machine was supposed to be licensed and taxed. To kind of crack down on that sort of behavior.
Interesting. Yeah. I thought it was legal all 50 states, but apparently you have to be 18 in South Carolina, according to Chad, anyways.
Well, possibly. I don't know if that would still be the case, but the other issue too is that maybe also because they were, you know, didn't have arcades at the time targeted for kids, most of them were installed in bars and other places where, you know, kids were not allowed.
Right.
And then of course when the drinking age went to 21, then probably not simply 18. This probably wasn't the cutoff at that point, but who knows?
Right. Interesting. I've heard stories about some of the early MIT hackers sourcing pinball parts and putting things together of interest.
That would not surprise me.
the model rail club that they had there, the whole switching and logic and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was in Packer's book by Stephen Levy.
That would not surprise me.
If I remember right, it's been a long time since I've read that. Well, now I'm going to be on a mission to source out a Coco computer and
Yeah, Coco with drive wire is probably your lowest barrier. You can often load it from cassette. You can just get a cassette cable and, you know, basically play the WAV file out of any sort of media player. And then that won't be enough to bootstrap you into DriveWire, I believe.
Cool.
I've got one for mine. I have to set up a DriveWire system at some point. And I've, you know, tinkered with the cassette interface because I've got a cassette cable for that as well. I also have some bank switchable cartridge ROMs, ROM boards for it that I have to get around to putting together, which will make my life easier. I also have a Glenside IDE interface I inherited, which would be nice to get up and running too. That needs work.
Nice.
I would probably, you know, just interface it to a compact flash card adapter rather than run a spinning disk on it, but it's cool that those things were made and they exist. More mass storage options, the better.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. Fuick. I wonder if Alan Cox is still developing that, or if it's the...
May have a life of its own. Fuick,
yeah,
I believe.
Fuick, yeah. I wonder. Wonder. I think he's totally out of the Linux kernel, isn't he? Altogether?
Yeah, I think so. I think he left some time ago. That
Interesting.
I think there was some comment made about a differences of opinions on certain things, and it was time for him to leave the project.
Yeah.
Kind of situation.
Yeah, I seem to remember Linus Torvalds being really harsh, supposedly, to a fix that he made that broke a number of things, apparently. Not that Alan made, but I don't remember.
Yeah.
It was a while ago.
Yeah, I know. Torvalds can be abrasive at times.
Interesting.
But yeah, it's cool that he went and did that little project. It was kind of interesting to see it run, you know, very Linuxy, Unixy operating system that ran on the Color Computer line of computers. It wasn't particularly fast. It wasn't particularly fully capable, but you know, it did do what you expected it to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I just have a web page pulled up here. Yeah, Fuzix. Ah, it's a tiny System V kernel, initially for Z80. Interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah, I guess if it was originally targeting the Z80, so probably, you know, anything capable of running CPM would probably also run that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, at least that would be a good bet, I would think. Pardon me. Well, I think we are slowly running out of time, or very rapidly running out of time. So this has been, I guess, Vintage Comp with Jazz Maz and SCM tonight.
Thank you for listening to
Open Voice. Yes, absolutely.
Now you can be the DJ with S3M overnight. I guess maybe I'll check back in tomorrow during the daytime, or at least daytime for me, open VOIP hours and see if there's anything of interest going on.